Hello, everybody. Welcome to another show. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards, the host of You're the Cure. And I'm honored today to have what I would consider, and I think most folks would consider, the world's authority, the leading expert on aluminum. We're going to talk about the effects of aluminum in the body. For new listeners who may not know, I was trained in conventional medicine. I'm a medical doctor, family practice. 10 years ago, I learned that all these inflammatory-based diseases, which are basically all of them, from cancer to heart disease to autism to Alzheimer's to ulcerative colitis, you name it, they're all inflammation-based. And as I started to dig into that and met a few doctors, mentors of mine who had gone ahead of me, they all figured out if you can remove what's in the body, it's disrupting normal function at the mitochondrial level mostly, and be sure to give the body all that it needs to function, especially at the mitochondrial level. Give the body what it needs, avoid what it doesn't. The body will function like it's supposed to. It knows how to deal with these inflammatory processes. The mitochondria knows how to be efficient and make energy and clear the exhaust appropriately, all the free radicals, but it must be equipped appropriately. So after 10 years and 20,000 patients, we've seen numerous quote unquote incurable diseases go into remission when you can identify and remove the things that are blocking normal function. Sounds super simple, but it's amazing when you do the basic thing of removing what's driving the inflammation or disrupting the normal cellular processes. And of course, be sure to give the body what it needs. Mostly that's nutritionally, but also movement, hydration, and most of all, peace instead of stress, fight or flight mode. So basic, so simple. I almost feel guilty when these quote unquote miracle stories happen. These patients get well from these diseases. And all we did was coach them on how to clean up their diet and lifestyle, basically. And that's really, we want to talk about that today with Dr. Christopher Exley, PhD. But the conversation is also going to address the corruption in the field of science, research science, and medical science both. It's a fascinating story. Let me just say real quick before we bring Dr. Exley in, how I heard first heard of Dr. Exley. So I had a patient actually ask me one day, and this was early on, about vaccines. Now, I've got six kids, and the first three are fully vaccinated, the last three less so. The last one, actually, she in particular decided there's not one that provides more benefit than risk, so we're waiting on her. But back to the patient that approached me and said, "Doc, I was reading the package insert for the hepatitis vaccine that they want to give my baby on day of life one, and it says there's 250 micrograms of aluminum in that shot." And through research, this patient determined that the FDA safe limit of aluminum, which we'll ask Dr. Exley if there's any safe level, but was 40 to 50 micrograms. So why would there be 250 micrograms in this injection when the safe limit by the FDA is considered to be 40? That got me to looking into the package insert. In medical school, I didn't learn any of the package inserts of any of these vaccinations. I learned what the CDC schedule was, and then I learned I needed to convince every patient in my clinic to stick to the schedule. But as I went and looked at that schedule, 2, 4, and 6 months, and then 12, 15, and 18 months old is a CDC schedule, and I added up all the aluminum and all the injections by the 18th birthday, if that baby were to stay on schedule, it would be 4,925 micrograms of aluminum in that child. That gave me pause. And so I went on a hunt for research that would tell me, is this safe? Is it not safe? Is there potential harm? I'd rather err on the side of caution. That led me to Dr. Christopher Exley, the world's renowned expert in aluminum. And that's why, in part, we're bringing him on the show. And then when I read about what happened to him and his funding and what I would dare say is pure corruption that led to him being defunded and the interplay between industry and research dollars and medical school education dollars, We just need to have this conversation. So Dr. Christopher Exley, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ben. That was an interesting introduction.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you for joining us. I want to give you an opportunity. I know you've spent, is it 40 years of your life, 30 or 40 years of your life, in the research field, specifically aluminum, correct?
It's pretty close to that. Yeah, I began looking at aluminium or aluminum when in 1984 as part of my first degree in biology. I just came across it. I mean, I was living up in Scotland, working at the University of Stirling there and doing my degree there. And in those days, one of the big subject areas of environmental pollution was acid rain and how acid rain was impacting upon fish and forests and the environment in general. And what we didn't really understand was why, for example, we were losing fish in our salmon rivers and was it the acidity or was it something else? And so that's what got me interested. And of course, what we found out pretty quickly and alongside people working in places like North America in the Adirondacks and in Norway was that it's not actually the acidity that was killing the fish. It was aluminium that was killing the fish. And it was the acidity that was releasing the aluminium into the water. The water previously would have really very, very low amounts of aluminium, almost undetectable amounts. But once the pH of the water fell from what would have been normally about pH 6 or 7 down to perhaps pH 4 or 4.5, then the aluminium was dissolved from all the rocks and the soils and became available to the fish and was killing the fish. So that was how I got hooked. And I think hooked is a good one because I'm a fisherman myself and I was working on fish at the time and I've never managed to throw that hook since. So it's still somewhere lodged in my mouth and it's still, even now, when they've done everything they can to remove me from the scene, I still find myself being reeled in by people like yourself. So that's how I started.
Well, it's fascinating, a fisherman. You know, it kind of reminds me of Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s story of he was really out to protect the fish in the waterways, specifically from factories that were dumping mercury into the waters. So his environmental, take on things. But then he had a lady bring him a pile of research about mercury in the vaccination. So I don't want to go off on that tangent, but an interesting correlation there. So as you started to look at the acid rain, the fish and the effects on that, you moved into the human population as far as your study?
Yeah, I mean, I was never, while I am, was a keen fisherman, I was never a fish biologist. The fish really was very quickly became my experimental animal. It was something that I could use to learn, in this case, about how aluminium impacts on living things. So those almost 40 years, it started off with a simple question. Well, one is, why has aluminium absolutely no function, no biological function or essentiality in any living organism? And indeed, our research showed thereafter that not only in any living organism, but any organism that had lived previously. In other words, it had never been biologically available to be used as an essential metal. And I wanted to understand why that was the case. And that brought me into not only animal studies, but indeed lots of biochemistry and what we call bioinorganic chemistry. I had to learn the chemistry of aluminium. A lot of people get put off by the word chemistry, I think. And I wrote my only book very recently, Imagine You Are an Aluminium Atom. And in there, I try to tell people, look, don't be afraid by certain scientific terms, and one of those being chemistry. And I explained for me, I mean, if you go on this terrible thing, Wikipedia, or whatever it's called, somebody there, whoever wrote that, says that I'm a chemist. I'm not a chemist, I'm a biologist, but I learned the chemistry I needed to know to understand the biology I was interested in. I became interested in what aluminium was doing to living things. And of course, at the same time, which is the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, there was quite a lot of research on the role of aluminium in human diseases like Alzheimer's disease. And in those days, you could actually research this area. And, you know, you were not castigated for doing so. It was possible to get research grants to look at the possible role of aluminium in human disease. No longer the case, but in those days it was. And so I was asked more and more times, well, what about this? What about that? With respect to human physiology and human disease. And so we started to look at, and specifically, actually, we started to look at Alzheimer's disease. So in the early 90s, one of the programs in my research team became aluminium and Alzheimer's disease, and has ever since. In fact, some would say that is the area where we have made the most significant progress in some respects, certainly with respect to human disease. I've just written a, I don't know when you've come across this Substack thing that's going around at the moment. So I thought I'm gonna dip my toe in there, since I no longer have an institution. I no longer have a platform from which to talk. So I've dipped my toe in Substack, and I wrote something actually just yesterday on this very subject about the role of aluminium in Alzheimer's disease. So that became something that my group were doing a lot of. And you mentioned earlier that you got into aluminium through an interest in vaccines. And I didn't start to look at this problem until, well, about the end of about 2008, 2009. So by then I'd done 25 years of research on aluminium, and it just had never crossed my mind how important it actually was that we were injecting our infants with aluminium as an adjuvant in a vaccine. So it was quite a long time after we started to look at that, and that then became an important part of our research program, and up until they cancelled me last year, it was a very significant part. And again, an area where we made really, I think, really significant progress. I'm not sure whether I answered your original question there.
You did, and then some. Thank you very much. I want to definitely get to the autism. I want to back up to the Alzheimer's, though, and I definitely want to encourage everybody to go read that Substack article. I've heard you in some other interviews, I believe, I don't want to misquote you, but basically paraphrasing here, it would be impossible for a human to get Alzheimer's in a human, normal human lifespan, say 100-year lifespan, without aluminium or aluminum in the brain. Explain, is that, number one, is that true and accurate? And then kind of explain that a little bit. Is that what your research showed, or how did you come to that conclusion?
Yeah, well, this was, I put my head on the guillotine or above the parapet in 2017 in writing an editorial for a journal called Journal of Alzheimer's Disease Reports, where I decided that my nearly 30 years research on aluminium and Alzheimer's disease, combined with everybody else's work in this field, that we now had enough information to be much more forthright about the possible role of aluminium in Alzheimer's. And I used the word possible then, but what I said was, and I believe it very strongly today, was that we now know that in the absence of aluminium in human brain tissue, you would not have Alzheimer's disease within a normal lifetime of an individual. And I said, possibly that's, 100 years. It doesn't mean, of course, that aluminium is a sole cause of Alzheimer's disease. But what it really means is, you're a doctor, your neurons are, they're immortal, essentially. Yeah. They are an immortal cell line. So why are they dying in normal human life? They don't a skin cell divides thousands and thousands of times, and that's why they die. A neuron has, well, there's virtually no division, some sort of neurogenesis, but no real division. In other words, they are not subject to the same factors that reduce longevity in other cells in the body. So they are immortal as far as I'm concerned. And maybe some neuroscientists will argue with me, but I have written this too in scientific publications. No one has argued with me. So I need to find out, well, why is it? What is it that is bringing neurons to an early death? And the most significant neurotoxin in human brain tissue, and most widely throughout humans, wherever you are, in whatever country, etc., is aluminium. And there is no controversy, is aluminium neurotoxic? We know it is neurotoxic from those situations where someone has been exposed to high levels of aluminium inadvertently and has got to the brain and caused massive neuronal cell loss. Often things like encephalopathies, massive cell death in certain areas of the brain. So we know that aluminium is neurotoxic. And again, perhaps the controversy has always been, well, how much aluminium do you need before you, you know, start to produce it's sufficient, what should we call it, sufficient pressure on neurons such that they have a reduced lifetime. And there are myriad possible mechanisms whereby once aluminium is inside a neuron, and bearing in mind, there are no mechanisms neither to put aluminium in a neuron nor to take aluminium out. The body does not deal with metals that have a 3+ charge. There's only one that you and I know about, and that's iron 3+, which is stored in ferritin, but is only used as iron 2+. It's not used as iron 3+. There are no mechanisms for removing a 3+ metal cation in or out of a cell. So once aluminium has got in, and we've written some papers on how that happens, it will get out again just through, just because of other processes where it might piggyback on or something of that sort. Or, of course, when a cell dies, it gets out. But it accumulates. And over time, there is a pretty strong correlation between how much aluminium is in human brain tissue and age. So we know that aluminium accumulates with age. And once it's there, we know that it can produce neurotoxicity by, as I said, myriad possible mechanisms. One very simple one is, if a neuron is dealing with a contaminant, let's call it, on a daily basis, it is using up energy. So neurons do have an energy budget. That is one reason why a neuron may eventually decide to kill itself, probably by apoptosis or to die, because it hasn't got enough. You talked about mitochondria before. It hasn't got the energy capacity to continue. But if you are dealing with a contaminant on a daily basis for decades, your energy levels will fall. So it could be as simple as an energy deficit that eventually produces neuronal loss. But it can also be something more direct than that, because one of the things about, if you talk to the aluminium industry, for years and years and years, they told everybody it was benign. Nothing could be further from the truth. Aluminium is absolutely one of the most reactive metals in the body. And it will disrupt most of our really important biochemical systems, such as anything involving where magnesium would be a cofactor. Aluminium will replace magnesium, and it does so, it's 1,000 times more avidly than magnesium can. So it always outcompetes magnesium in many, many different departments. And if you're suddenly outcompeting magnesium, then your ATP levels, for example, are going to be in trouble. Anything that's driven by ATP will be disrupted by the presence of aluminium. And that's just one example. But you've got something. I mean, you talked about free radicals earlier. And one of my most read papers was where I proposed how aluminium forms a free radical with the superoxide radical anion to form a semi-reduced superoxide radical cation. So aluminium is what's called a pro-oxidant. It only has one oxidation state itself, but in the presence of any other oxidizing procedure, such as one that might be driven by iron, for example, it can make that oxidated damage 10 times worse at a very low concentration. So oxidated damage would be another mechanism whereby that aluminium in the neuron is producing a lot of stress for the neuron. The neuron fights back. Of course it does. I mean, our bodies are magnificently robust and they fight back all the time. But as I said previously, there is an energy death. There is a level of energy that you only have. And you know, if you're going to use all that up fighting off aluminium, you're not going to have what you need for essential processes.
Right. I recall reading somewhere in one of your papers possibly, but when it comes to the amount of aluminium in the brain, and I think this was in regards to a child with autism that had died for some other reason, but they did an autopsy and someone measured the amount of aluminium. Can you discuss that a little bit? And how could a child have that much? And the mechanism, even, I think another one of your papers talks about the immune system cells that'll take the aluminum from the vaccine in the shoulder or the buttocks, and it'll travel to the brain. So talk a little more about these children, the amount of aluminum in the brain on autopsy.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about our work, and probably the piece of work that suddenly branded me as an anti-vaxxer, of course, because I was questioning the safety of vaccines. It's interesting, so you bring that up, but I've just said to you that aluminium accumulates in brain tissue over decades, and in that time, you know, most people are getting Alzheimer's disease, well, they're getting it earlier and earlier actually now, but most historically we'd think of people getting Alzheimer's disease in their 70s and 80s and 90s. Now, when we then had the opportunity to measure the aluminium content of human brain tissue from individuals who died with a diagnosis of autism, some of those, we were able to look at 10 individuals in all, but we're only able to do quantitative analysis on 5 individuals because of the nature of the tissue that was provided by the brain bank. It was all of the tissue available in the United Kingdom, all of the individual donors. We found really quite alarming amounts of aluminium in the brain tissue of individuals, some of whom were adolescents, 13, 14, 15 years old. We'd never ever come across anything like this before. We normally only find high levels of aluminium in the very old. Now, the amounts we found in autism brain tissue were even beyond that. They were absolutely some of the highest at the time amounts of aluminium ever recorded in human brain tissue. And we had to find a mechanism for that. Now, of course, at the same time, we had our program looking at the role of aluminium adjuvants. And we just published some research showing that what happens at the vaccine injection site is that these immune competent cells come into the vaccine injection site and they eat aluminium. They take the adjuvant, the actual particulate aluminium inside them. And not only that, they can load up with it without it causing them any particular immediate problem. So they don't immediately die. They're able to actually fill their cytoplasm with small vesicles of aluminium adjuvant. Now, that in itself, you know, when we published it, we said, look, you know, this is the first time that this has actually been shown. And, you know, when actually we put this paper for review, the reviewers said, well, yeah, we know this already. And I said to them, well, okay, show us where it's been shown before. And then they realized, no, this was just something that was assumed a possible way whereby aluminium adjuvants work. So we showed this, and not only that these cells loaded themselves with aluminium, but they were then viable. They go off to the lymph nodes where they could be helping with the immune response, but they can go anywhere in the body. These are the, you know, the equivalents of the white blood cells that we have. Now, when we did the autism study, we were also able to do some microscopy on 10 individuals because we had fixed tissues which allowed us to do microscopy. And we have developed in just previous to this, a few years previous to this, a method for actually visualizing aluminium in human tissue and human brain tissue using fluorescence microscopy, a method that was unequivocal, a method that only produced fluorescence for aluminium. So when my colleague Matt Mould, who is a fantastic microscopist, and all the microscopy you see in our papers on our website has been done by Matthew, when he did the work on the autism brain tissues, we found something which in some respects was even more alarming than the quantitative analysis. We found that nearly all the aluminium was inside cells which were either, for example, lymphocytes traversing the blood-brain barrier, or the glia, which are like the housekeeping cells of the brain. We found very little in neurons. We found quite a lot of debris in certain areas, cell debris, which could have been where neurons had died. But in terms of where the aluminium was, it was nearly all in non-neuronal cells, and it was in the exact same cells that we saw at the vaccine injection site that were loading up with aluminium. So we now know that not only can these cells go to the lymph node where they will eventually deposit their aluminium, but they can go to brain tissue. Now, these cells don't last forever. We've managed to work on them in vitro, and we've shown that they can last for maybe a week, maybe a little bit longer. But once you've got this massive aluminium load, eventually it kills them. And when it kills them, they've just released the aluminium wherever they are. And if they're in an infant's brain tissue, they release it there and then in that infant's brain tissue. And that is more than capable of producing an encephalopathy, more than capable of producing, you talked about it earlier, a significant inflammatory event. And therein lies a possible mechanism whereby we do know that many, many infants suffer terribly following vaccination, and we don't know why. And perhaps this is a reason why. And of course, there is an autism epidemic. We don't understand why that is. But all the evidence we have suggests that aluminium contributes to that. You know, I've heard people say that autism is Alzheimer's disease for kids, and they're not so far wrong, because sort of ways in which it influences brain function and the functions of the individuals are not so different when you see them in an infant or a child or an adolescent, or you see in someone with advanced stage Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, I'm
fascinating.
I'm unequivocal about aluminium and Alzheimer's disease, but unfortunately, our research was stopped before I could become unequivocal about aluminium and autism. But until someone provides evidence to the contrary, right now, aluminium has a role in autism.
Agreed. And we're going to have to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about that exactly. Why did nobody ever question your research for 25 years or so, and then all of a sudden they question it greatly but won't debate you on the actual facts and the data, and then your funding goes away. So we've got to get into all of that, but we'll also I do want to talk about too, when we come back from the break, ways to deal with this, if there is a way to deal with this aluminum, aluminum that is inside of us. So everybody, y'all stick with us. And before we go to the break, Dr. Exley, what's the best way for people to follow you and your work and read more about you?
Yeah, well, you know, I am actually officially retired at the moment. So, but my colleague, Matt Mould, who is also, he's a young man looking for a job. So anybody out there needs a fantastic scientist, he's looking for one. But in the meantime, we're keeping a website together. And the name of the website is aluminiumresearchgroup.com. You have to use the English aluminium, and it's all one word, lowercase. It's on my emails if you're able to paste it somewhere to your
listeners. We'll put that in the show notes, everybody, the aluminiumresearchgroup.com.
Yeah.
And also the book. What was the name of the book one more time?
Imagine you are an aluminium atom.
And
there's a reason for that. Can I say the book is my pride and joy. I actually wrote most of it during the first lockdown because of this nonsense that we've all been subjected to. And I never knew what it was. I'd never found time to write a book. So perhaps I can, you know, at least take something positive out of what's happened over the last couple of years, because the book is as good as I'm going to get. I'm not going to write another. And I hope that it stands the test of time. I think it will. And I hope it's also a very readable, and that you don't worry about, I hope, you know, the science. It's not heavy science. And it includes links to everything that we have done as well. So, and it's cheap and cheerful, I think. So people should have a look.
All right. Well, I will definitely have a look and encourage everybody else too. We'll put that in the show notes also, guys. Imagine you're an aluminium atom. So y'all check that out down in the show notes. We will be right back with Dr. Christopher Exley, PhD. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. You're the cure. Okay, everybody, we're back. Dr. Chris Exley on the show today. So excited to have the world's expert leading authority on aluminium in Great Britain, or aluminum here in the States. Y'all check out his book, Imagine You Are an Aluminium Atom, and then also his website, aluminiumresearchgroup.com. Lots of good interviews on there, and publications, the papers he's written, and then my leaving statement. We're going to get into that real, but before we do, because we do need to get into the corruption that is just rampant in medicine and science right now. But I want to talk about silica real quick. I've heard you talk about silica water, salicylic acid, basically as an antidote. So maybe we should touch on, besides injections, vaccines that could deliver aluminium to you, what are the most common sources, in your opinion, that humans get exposed to this aluminium? And then what's a way, if there is one, to detoxify yourself from it or protect yourself from it?
Okay. First, salicylic acid. Not salicylic. I think that's aspirin, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Salicylic acid.
Salicylic acid. Okay, let's... Listen, obviously I write extensively about this in the book, and so you and I have only got limited time here, but all processed foods are going to have significantly more aluminium in them, and therefore you are going to be exposed to significantly more aluminium if you live on processed foods, whether it be drinks or solid foods. And indeed, many medications also, not only vaccines, many medications include aluminium as an active ingredient. So, you know, if you can live naturally, inverted commas, as possible, you will reduce significantly how much aluminium gets inside your body. Now, if I can just quickly go back to my work on fish. Because the first paper I published, which is was in the esteemed journal Nature, which is supposed to be the best scientific journal in the world, I showed that silicon protected against the toxicity of aluminium in fish. And we speculated that silicon might also help against aluminium toxicity in humans. And I spent the rest of my life proving this in some respect. We did all of the chemistry of how silicon reacts with aluminium. And it's not silicon, it's the soluble form of silicon, which is called silicic acid. Be careful with the word silica. Silica is sand. It is a solid form of silicon. In fact, silicic acid, when it goes above what we call its saturation or its solubility limit, produces silica. But most natural waters contain silicic acid. Now, what we found was later on very quickly that if you drank anything with silicic acid in there, you would pee aluminium in your urine. And this was then a possible treatment or therapy. And we used it to look at people, for example, with Alzheimer's disease. And we showed that people with Alzheimer's disease who drank a mineral water that was rich, high levels of silicic acid, high levels of silicon, over 30 milligrams per liter, not only did they pee aluminium in their urine, but in some cases, it improved their cognitive function significantly. Now, actually, this was 20% of the people in our clinical trial showed a medically significant improvement in cognitive function after drinking a silicon-rich mineral water for only 12 weeks. I would challenge anyone out there to find me an Alzheimer's drug either that has been tested or indeed is currently being used that has that level of efficiency. And in fact, when we published this in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease in 2013, I hope we'll get funding to do a trial, a large trial, because this trial was only 15 individuals with Alzheimer's and their carers, so 30 individuals in all. We hope we'd get the money to do a large trial. Did we get that money? No, of course we didn't. In many ways, you can think that the work was, again, a bit like me, cancelled. I mean, it was just ignored. And, one can speculate as to why, but perhaps, when you see the situation I am in now, you understand why. When you start to ask questions that others don't want to know the answers for, you are asking for trouble. And that's what I have been doing all of my scientific life, but it's only recently, and I talk about this in the Substack, it's only recently that some of those answers are becoming unequivocal. In other words, we are really now stepping on the toes of the aluminium industry. They are running scared from this research. They need to see this research gone, finished, stopped. They can't stop what's already in the literature, but you know what? They can ignore it, and they can help other organizations to ignore it. It's incredible. When we published the research on autism, I expected it to be on the news at 10 on every single news channel in the world. It wasn't picked up by anybody. Not a single outlet of any sort picked that research up. That is the power to keep certain things out of mainstream. And of course, we know about that power now because of COVID. We know how easy it is to keep science out of the mainstream discussions on COVID. But before that, aluminium was kept out of the mainstream completely and utterly. Even my own university censored from about 5 years ago, censored all our work. They never mentioned it. It was never promoted. It was, regardless of how, where it was published, it made no difference to them. So that's where, you talked about the corruption. Well, corruption, yes, but it's just simply the power of an industry to prevent knowledge becoming widely known.
Yes, and I heard you in one interview, I think, say, if all this research on aluminum, if it came to light, if it was widely broadcast, and you would think your own university, when you're you're supporting and housing the world's authority on something with this incredible research coming out on Alzheimer's and autism, two of these devastating diseases that everybody wants to find a cure for, and these poor people suffering. You would think you'd be the poster child. They put you on a billboard up at the university, but that's not the case, unfortunately.
No.
So explain a little bit. I mean, people get it, I think, with Monsanto and glyphosate and, you know, the big tobacco industry and big pharmaceutical, but this is an industry most people don't probably know about and the impacts, but you said all the world stock markets would crash if the news really got out because it's so pervasive, this substance, aluminum, used throughout industry. So it's a huge industry, but how does a research scientist like you get funded for the general public who maybe doesn't know? You know, you're at a university, you're tenured, you're well experienced, you've spent decades working, but where do you get your money from?
Yeah, well, again, for the first nearly 30 years, I was able to get funding through established funding routes. I was able to get it through government-run research councils. I had to put in probably 10 applications to get one funded. But I was able to get funding. There wasn't a complete and utter sort of blockage. But that got worse and worse and worse to the extent that about 10 years ago, it became almost impossible to get funding from any of the obvious routes. So for obvious routes for me would be, again, government funding through what we call the research councils, like your NIH or organizations like that. In fact, I got NIH funding about 10 or 12 years ago. So it was possible, but it became almost impossible. I couldn't get any of the large charities involved, the Wellcome Trust you might have heard of, but all of the disease charities, the Alzheimer's Society, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, none of these would touch our research. And when one looks into the background of these organizations, you understand why. So, I mean, you know, the Alzheimer's Disease Society, they're for the last two or three decades, their chief scientific advisors have been what I call ambassadors for the aluminium industry. They're people who work for the aluminium industry on the side. They get paid by the aluminium industry. So we know that the aluminium industry infiltrates large charities. It infiltrates government panels. And what happened was about 10 years ago, I said, look, we need to find another source of funding. So I put all my effort into philanthropy and philanthropic services. And it worked to a certain extent. You know, we were able to bring in from different sorts of both from philanthropic organizations, but also from individual donors. We were able to bring in what I needed to run a lab, which was only about £200,000 a year, but I managed to do it. And I managed to do it right up until the day they got rid of me. But what it meant was that we depended entirely to do our research, certainly in the last 5 years, 100% on philanthropy. And, you know, my university pressured, I know it's not the university per se, I know it's people pressuring them. The university have other investors who have told them, you know, this has got to stop. And my university then decided the only way to stop Exley, who seems to be able to bring in donations from all over the world, and I was doing, and we were always getting this £100,000-£200,000 a year, keep the group going and produce what we believe to be fantastic research. They just said, right, from now on, you cannot receive any funding from any, not just philanthropic services, not just donations, but from any charity at all. So Wellcome Trust, Royal Society, any of the lot, we were not. This only applied to me, by the way, not to anybody else in the university. This was a single thing just applied to me. And how can I argue against it? You know, they are in charge, so you know, they couldn't sack me. They have tried by different methods in the past, by the way, but they couldn't just sack me because, as you say, I had tenure. But am I going to go into university with no money, no group, no ability to do research, and just what? Spend my time being some tired old academic doing teaching and other things, administration? No, this was never my objective of being in academia, and it wasn't going to change now. So, you know, that's, you talked about my leaving statement. The details of how that happened are in that leaving statement. And I want to say, I want to just make it clear now. First of all, everything in that leaving statement is backed up by documents that my lawyers obtained before I eventually resigned. And not only did we obtain those documents, but we, in my resignation, we obtained, we did not sign any non-disclosure agreements or anything with respect to this information. And this information essentially shows is that my vice chancellor, the vice chancellor is the head of the university in the United Kingdom. My vice chancellor wrote a discussion piece for the university's governing council in which he outlined that I was an anti-vaxxer and all of my research was anti-vax. So he just chose one element as a reason why he could get approval from the university's governing council to cancel all of my funding. Because all of that funding, he said, was being used to promote anti-vaccination strategies and research and anything else. I mean, he had no evidence for any of this. I mean, they disabled my Kiel website almost immediately, saying that it was an anti-vax website. Now, the website that my colleague Matt Mould has put up now, which you have given out the address for, is more or less the exactly same website that we reproduced, because, you know, they can close one link, but you know where the other stuff is available. You can find it and put it up again. And obviously, that's what we've done. But they just made it, they just decided that Chris Exley was an anti-vax. He was, I was the poster boy for anti-vaccination in the UK and probably around the world, and I had to be stopped. Now, listen, I do not mind anyone being anti-vaccination. There is no reason why anyone should be neither pro nor anti-vaccine. That is their personal choice. So first of all, why should one lose one's job anyway if one does not like vaccination? Well, I'm not in that category, by the way. And there never have been, and there's no evidence that that is the case, because all we've ever done is published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Nothing else.
And that nobody's ever, that I know of, questioned or called that peer-reviewed science wrong.
Nope.
Or challenged it in any way.
Only trolls on the internet. I mean, the trolls on the internet have said things like the autism paper has been retracted. You know, they make up lies and stuff. You know, we have never, like you said, if there is something wrong with any of the research that we have published in the scientific world, there is a mechanism. You write to the editor of the journal, you say, I would like to point out some problems with this paper. That goes through the editorial process, it goes through the peer review process, and an agreement comes between author, editor, and person making the suggestions. That's never happened. No one has ever done that, because our research is as strong as it can be. And I've challenged over and over again anyone to say that our research is wrong, or that we have some flaws, which means that it is wrong, or that our interpretations are wrong. You know, in the autism paper, we never mentioned vaccines. And yet that became, you know, I immediately became an anti-vaxxer because of that paper. We simply showed what is the case. And that is that in the case of quantitative analysis, in the five donor tissues that were available in the UK, all of them had very high levels of aluminium. And that in the 10 that were available to do microscopy work, we were able to see where that aluminium was, and it was in the non-neuronal cells some of those being things like lymphocytes equivalent to those cells that would go to a vaccine injection site and pick up aluminium adjuvant. This is not anything other than reporting what you have found. And yeah, no one has been able to refute that.
It just reminds me so much of Dr. Andy Wakefield, who I've interviewed before, and he was basically doing colonoscopies on children whose parents yeah. brought them in because they have severe GI distress. And he did some biopsies and found some evidence of the MMR viruses vaccine strain in the gut lining. And he basically yeah. reported that and said, let's investigate this. And I mean, they did basically the same thing to him in a different way.
Yeah, it's I know Andy, who's him and I have a connection.
Yes, you do. Unfortunately, but fortunately also, I mean, it takes people like both of you who are consummate professionals. You stick with the data, you stick with the science wherever it leads. And like you said earlier, I wrote this down, let me find it. When you basically start revealing things that people don't want revealed, I mean, follow the money. Yep. And we haven't mentioned the Bill Gates, and I'm not going to blame everything on him, but he seemed to control a lot of purse strings. And I'm going to yeah. assume that there's probably some Bill Gates money involved somewhere in here. Yeah. So
they are one of the major funding partners of Keele University.
Mm, yeah. Surprise. Shocking.
You know, wow. one of the pieces of evidence that my lawyer was able to get hold of, unfortunately, one piece that was heavily redacted, but this piece of evidence was an email from somebody that was redacted to the head of research at Keele University, essentially saying, we don't like this bad publicity about Keele and Exley and aluminium adjuvants and vaccines, and hopefully you're going to do something about it. And then the rest of it is all redacted. So, you know, there's no question that, yes, my university decided to fold under pressure from what they've called previously. When Bobby Kennedy tried to make a small charitable donation to my group, they rejected his donation based on the fact that him making a donation would upset their funding partners. Well, their funding partners are the people who have written to my university and said, okay, now we need to bring this to an end. And it goes quite far because, you know, things like Google is involved. Because previously, if you would Google Chris Exley, you would come up with so many different hits and different things. And all of a sudden, coincident when Keele stopped my funding, you Google Chris Exley and hardly anything comes up anymore. And in fact, you know, at the bottom of the page, it usually says suggested searches relating to this. All the suggested searches were to do with Keele University, not to do with me. So it goes very deep when something like Google is also censoring you.
Well, it's a travesty, really. I mean, and for the common person, I mean, the lay person out there who previous to COVID, so many put all their trust and hope and faith in this system that it was righteous and it was doing the right thing. And it is composed of many people like yourself who were doing the right thing. Yeah. But those at the top who control the money.
Yeah. The majority, and I would agree, are still trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't taint science or medicine with the views of these corrupt minority, and that's what they are.
Yeah. And when they control the media outlets, so you can't, when your own university won't even promote and publicize your work, much less any news station, mainstream media outlets or social media. I mean, you can trace it all back to who's going to lose money in the deal. And it's unfortunate, but people need to, and more are, I think, waking up to this fact, and they need to pursue independent media and independent channels to get their information from, like this show. So thank you, Dr. Exley, for being on our show. Well, and our goal is to educate the public to the point that they can change their diet and lifestyle, make some choices. It'll keep them out of our office. My goal is to shut down my medical clinic because there are no more sick people because they've learned the truth. They've applied the truth. And through folks like yourself, scientists working hard like yourself that are uncovering it.
Yeah. I mean, you're a trained doctor, but medicine should be about the healthy. Medicine should not be about the sick. We need a change. We need a paradigm shift. We should be about the healthy, because all we do, and you know this, you're a medic, all doctors do is hand out drugs. Mm-hmm. Almost nothing else is going on. I mean, I am at the moment at the mercy of my health service, and I've had 18 months of really severe pain, and all they want to do is give me high doses of corticosteroids and things that I do not want in my body. This is it. This is all they can offer.
Yeah.
So, you know, this.
I was going to say, we were trained for management. We manage pain. We manage blood sugar. We manage hypertension. We manage. We manage asthma. And there's certain conditions we don't know how to manage well, like Alzheimer's and autism. There's not a resolution. There's not a root cause analysis of it. We're simply not taught that. Medical school is glorified pharmacology. I'm a glorified pharmacologist. How do I dole out the management medication? And then you mentioned the medications are full of aluminum, many of them.
Yes.
And so when you just manage symptoms, there's unintended consequences of that instead of dealing with root causes. So I'm sorry for that pain you're in, and wish you were closer. We could maybe try to help that. But off air, maybe we can talk about that. We are out of time. We're going to have to maybe do a part two with you sometime, Dr. Exley. It's been fantastic. It's been our pleasure to have you on. Everyone, check out the book and the website. We're going to post those in the show notes. The book is Imagine You Are an Aluminium Atom. And then the website at aluminiumresearchgroup.com. Lots of good information on there. Dr. Exley, thank you very much for joining us, and we wish you well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right, everybody. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. Another great show here. Come back next week and we'll do it again. Thank you for joining us today. Goodbye, everybody.